Well, thanks everyone for coming tonight. When we were coming up with this topic, I had just come off of a men's training for ordination retreat. And on that retreat, we had explored the topic of confession. We'd kind of explored it in a different sort of way. So the way we were exploring it was just sort of the value and the virtue of kind of sharing with others, kind of our goals, our aspirations, our values, and in a way being clear about how we've fallen short of that as a way of kind of recommitting ourselves to those and trying to make that movement more effective. So that week was very inspiring for all of us. And one of the things about that week that really struck me was kind of this process of doing a moral inventory of kind of my life and thinking about what it was that I did want to change. Where did I let myself down? Where did I let my values down? Where was I less than what I wanted to be in my life? And I think when you do that, there is this quality of not turning away from that. There's this quality of really kind of staying in there with that question and being honest with yourself about you know, in a way, how much more meaningful your life could be, how much kinder you could be. And I think it's quite difficult to stay in that space. So I was reflecting a bit on that. And as we were sitting around, it was Marie and Vajrajyoti and I. And we were trying to figure out a theme for this 3 weeks. And we thought, well, maybe we could just talk about that practice of not turning away, of staying with, of, yeah. And if we were going to talk about that, then Vajrajyoti got all excited. And she's like, oh, great. Then Marie could do kind of the topic of not turning away from ourselves, and she could do the topic of not turning away from the world. And they're actually really well qualified to give those talks, which then left me with the intro talks, so we'll see how that goes. But I was kind of interested in what, for you, when you hear the practice of not turning away, what do you think it's not turning away from? Reality?
Changes.
Was what? There's a lot there, huh?
Your fears?
Fears, yeah.
Anything uncomfortable.
Uncomfortableness, yeah.
Change.
Challenge and pain, yep.
And joy. Beauty.
Joy and beauty, yeah. Can be terrifying. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Any others?
Relatives.
Yeah. I think there's some truth in that, isn't there? Well, when I thought of it, I thought of difficult situations, values, ideals, friendships. I think sometimes friendships can be very challenging. Conscience, turning away from my own conscience. I was thinking today about turning away, how easily I can turn away from exercise, eating well, and sleeping well, and things I don't want to look at or see. So I think with the idea of the practice of not turning away, it does imply that staying with some of these things that we value, or that there is kind of fruit to be had in them, it's not easy to stay with them. Yeah, but somehow it's more meaningful if we can stay with them. And sometimes it takes an effort to stay with it, to not turn away. And I wasn't sure how to kind of approach this topic. And for some reason, my mind turned to just some stories from the Buddha's life. So what I did was I thought back to a couple different stories, which I thought exemplified that quality of not turning away. And so that's what I'm going to do with you tonight, is share some stories from Buddha's life where I think this quality's pulled out. So the first one is, in these I think you would have I think you would have heard them before, probably. I know that this first one, I know Sujiva's given a talk on this. So the first one is the Baya Bhairava Sutta. It's called the, this isn't the one he talked on, but next one's the one he talked on. But this one's a sutta on fear and terror. Yeah? And basically, in this sutta, what happens is that a Brahmin comes up to the Buddha, which is usually the way these suttas start frequently. Someone comes up and asks a question. And the Brahmin says, well, you know, you're the leader of all these monks, right? And the Buddha's like, yep, I kind of, you know, I'm the Buddha. he says, well, what do you tell people? How do you help them kind of when they're enduring time in a forest, yeah, in the wilderness, dwelling in the wilderness, maintaining seclusion, and, you know, what do you tell them when fear and terror rises up in them, yeah? What do you tell them when they're not finding it easy to be alone? Yeah, because at that time, lots of monks would go off into the forest and be alone. And I think in a way, we've got to kind of take this a bit. I think you can take it literally. Who here has been on a solitary retreat? Any? You can put them up high. You can say, yeah, okay. So actually, what's wrong with this side of the room? You're already okay. You're already quiet. You've got no fear and dread. Well, they're all huddled. Yeah. So, when you go on your first solitary retreat, at least I think this is a common experience, and it's one I had, was that I had a lot of fear arise that first weekend that I did it. I went on the retreat, and I just was certain that there was somebody on the roof scraping the roof with their nails. And I still am not sure there wasn't, because I didn't go out and look, because I was terrified. But you know, my mind just went down in that direction, and it was almost like I couldn't help it. I had to work through that. But I think with respect to fear and terror in today's world, I think it can be very terrifying to go outside of the group, you know, to go outside of what society is kind of telling you the right values are. I think that can be terrifying. It can be really scary to do that. I think it can be really scary to not pursue material accumulation. Yep. I think that if you don't put your money into a house and insurance and kind of just building up wealth, you do wonder, well, what's going to happen to you as you get older? Yeah? And how much money do we really need? How much money do we need in order to be safe? And can money ever buy that safety anyways? But and I think it takes a lot of courage to to let yourself grow old and not chase after eternal youth. You know, I think it's very terrifying to grow old. I think it takes a lot of courage to live by spiritual values, yeah, particularly in this world, and to actually stand for those. Stand for, like, say, for example, mindfulness in the midst of so much intoxication of lots of different varieties. So what did the Buddha say? The Buddha said in this sutta, he basically said that fear and terror arises from unpurified states. So when your mind is in a state of, and he had a long list here, of covetousness and fiercely passionate for sensual pleasures, when the mind heart is filled with ill will and destructive attitudes, when you're overcome with sloth and torpor, when you're restless with an unstill mind, when you're uncertain and doubting, when you're given to praising ourselves and disparaging others, when you're tending towards panic and dread, when you're desirous of gains, offerings, and fame, when you're lazy and lacking in persistence, when you're muddled in your mindfulness and unalert, and when you're unconcentrated with straying mind, then when you do find yourself alone, fear and dread will arise. I really love the last one, though. I haven't said it yet. But he said the last condition is when you're a drooling idiot. So if you're a drooling idiot, then you will experience fear and terror. So, and what he said was that he actually knows that he's purified of these qualities. Yeah? That those things didn't have a hold on his mind. And because they didn't have a hold on his mind, he had more courage when he was staying with difficult situations. And I think this is really true. I think when a difficult situation arises, if you know in your mind that your mind is established in kindness, you know, that there is generosity there, that there is care for other people there, that there is a sense of awareness and mindfulness, that you're present. If you know that those things are there, then when you run across a difficult situation, you will have more courage. That's been my experience. But more than that, first then he said is that when the fear and dread did arise, and he knew that his mind was pure, he just stayed with his practice. So if he was walking in the forest in meditation, he would just keep walking. If he was sitting, he would keep sitting. If he was lying down, he just remained lying down. And I think there is something to that too. Another variety on this is when Shantideva talks about when ill will arises, just being like a block of wood, just kind of being inert, not letting that fear and that terror kind of get a grip on you, not letting the ill will get a grip on you. And he goes on to say too that in these situations, and I thought this was interesting, he said, people have the perception of day when it is night and night when it is day. But the Buddha has the perception of day when it is day and night when it is night. He is not subject to delusion. And I think this is an interesting caveat, because I think when we approach things which could excite fear and dread, fear and terror, if our mind's clear and we're seeing clearly, we realize that there isn't a kind of a killer on the roof scraping with nails. Yeah? You just know that doesn't happen. It happens in movies. Yeah? But it's Sudarshan Loka. I was up in Maine somewhere. I mean, people are crazier in Maine. I was kind of, you know. So, but people, you know, that doesn't, you know, it's just fear. It's fantasy and fear. And I think if you can be clear about that, like the Buddha was, then you just know. You can just work with it more effectively. You kind of know where your mind is. You're not allowing those kind of confusions to color your response. And when he stayed with the fear and dread, in this occasion, he said what then arose was spiritual qualities. So he went deeper. And I think this is true too, that if you can kind of make it through those moments when like lots of bits of you want to leave, there is an opportunity to break through to something deeper. So say, for example, I think I have this sometimes in meditation. I can be in meditation and my mind can be very agitated to the point where I want to kind of get up and leave. But if I can sort of make my way through that, I can usually find something on the other end which is a lot more deeper and calmer. But I've got to get through that bog. I've got to get through that difficult patch. You know, and one of the ways to do it is to stay with what I'm already committed to, which is my meditation practice. So that's one sutta. Another story from the Buddha's life that I thought was interesting along this point was the Buddha and Ananda. This is from the Vinaya Pitaka, which is a collection of stories about the monks. Yep, so it's not the Pali Canon per se, I don't think. But so in this story, the Buddha and Ananda is the Buddha's attendants, they're coming, they're walking along the road, and they're kind of walking around the different huts where the monks live. And they come across a monk who's lying in a pool of his own excrement. Yep. He's got dysentery, and he is just lying there in pain and in difficulty. And they're like, "Oh, what's happening? How did this happen? Kind of, what are you doing? You know, kind of, is no one looking after you?" And he's like, and the old monk, he doesn't even really say much besides, "No, no one's looking after me. I'm useless. I'm useless to the other monks. I'm of no use to them. And so no one's actually looking after me." And so the Buddha immediately, just in Ananda, just clean up the monk, clean him up and get him into a bed and you know, get him settled and in a more comfortable position. And after that, the Buddha goes to the monks who are staying in that area, and he says, there's a monk here with kind of, there's a monk here with dysentery, yeah? And the other monks are like, yeah, there is. And he's like, well, is anybody looking after him? They're like, oh, no one's looking after him. He's kind of a bit useless. And then the Buddha goes on to say, well, actually, you do need to look after him. You do need to care for one another because you've gone forth from home, and you are the only family you've got is one another. And so you do have to care for one another. And there's a really good lecture on this sutta by Sangharakshita called A Case of Dysentery. And he talks about friendship and the virtues of friendship and kind of in a way in the Sangha how we do have to look after one another. But I thought this was a really good example of not turning away too in a couple of regards. I think first of all, the Buddha just saw what needed to happen and just acted. He just responded directly to the situation. And I think that's an interesting facet of not turning away. That sometimes, you know, we turn away because we kind of can't be bothered or we don't want to make the effort. But learning not to do that, but to actually respond to the situation is really powerful, you know, and really kind of important thing to do. In this case, it was just a sense of compassion, from the Buddha's perspective. But he also didn't jump to any conclusions. He, instead of kind of assuming that he understood what was going on, he asked the other monks in the community kind of what was happening. And in the other monks, once the Buddha had explained, well, you know, actually you do need to care for one another, the other monks saw that and they basically apologized. Yeah. So I think that's also another aspect of not turning away, is that when you do find that, and I think this was one of the things that came out on our retreat, when you do find that you haven't lived up to your ideals and you could have done better, yeah, you actually, when it's pointed out to you, you see it and you sort of apologize and try and make amends. And part of me kind of assumes that they took care of this man afterwards. Yeah. So one of the things I thought about with this was the kind of a question, if not me, who? Because I remember once I was doing dishes at Windhorse Trading, which was a business I worked at. And it seemed to me like I always had to do the dishes. Yeah, it was the tea counter and the tea room, and no one ever did them, it felt like. And it felt like I always had to do them. And I was complaining. Yeah? And somebody came in and they said, well, why not you? And I thought, yeah, why not me? I think sometimes kind of with stuff that's difficult and challenging, you just happen to be the one there. Yeah, you just happen to be there at that moment and you've got an opportunity to do something. And so you have an opportunity to do something. So you can take that opportunity or not. So another story from the Buddha's life was, this is a story that I couldn't find the Pali for it, but it's in the Tales of Freedom, which is Vasantra's book. And what basically happened was that in the Buddha's time, he was getting, well, his followers were receiving alms food and support from the local community. And whenever you receive support, of course, someone else wasn't getting the support you'd received, because in those days it was very, you know, if you lived the monastic life, you lived the spiritual life, you were supported by the population to do that. So food, donation of food and housing and clothing and all that would come to you. So he's his community is actually getting a lot of support, and some people got kind of a bit upset about this, and very diabolically, they arranged for this young follower in their sect to start visiting the monks, just visiting them on a regular basis. And at some point in time, she was visiting, and they kind of suggested she go in the evening. I think the story even goes, they suggested they'd go with her so she'd be safe. And they killed her. They killed her and they put her in a ditch. This is how the story goes. And then they covered her up, the body. And the next day they went to the king and they said, you know, we can't find our friend. Yep, she's this young girl. We're really worried about her. She went out last night. And she hasn't come back, and we're worried about her safety. And the king's like, well, do you know where she went? Do you know where to look for her? And they said, well, she used to hang out a lot with the Buddha's followers, you know, and the monks. So maybe we should go there. The king said, well, yeah, look for her there. Go there and try and look for her. So they then went over to the area where the Buddha's followers were, where the monks were, and they rooted around. They said, oh, has anybody seen her? Does anybody know where she is? Of course, people said, no, we haven't seen her for a while. And then they do find her, though, in the ditch. And then they kind of take the body and they say, oh, look, you know, these monks probably killed her. They probably, one of the monks, I don't know, had their way with her, or she was maybe going to tell on them or something, but basically tried to peg her death onto the Buddha's disciples. So when this story got out to the general public, basically, the general public was very upset, to say the least, and they withdrew their support for the monks, for the Buddhist monks. And the Buddhist monks then came to the Buddha and said, look, we've really got to defend ourselves. We have to do something about this because, you know, we didn't do it. We didn't do it. And we're getting blamed for it, and it's resulting in a lot of pain and suffering for us and also for others. And the Buddha just said, well, we don't really have to do anything. All we have to do is continue, just continue with our practice and just assert the truth that when people lie or when they hide the truth, it's a very serious has very serious spiritual consequences. So that's what the monks did. They just sort of just kept doing their practice, living their life, which a monastic life is dedicated to meditation and simple lifestyle and stuff. They just kept doing that, and they just, you know, even though they were being blamed, they just kept asserting that, you know, that it's very serious to lie and to hide the truth, and just, you know, they didn't do it. And then it just all blew over. And I thought this was another interesting example of not turning away. Because you would, when people, you can't control how other people are going to respond to what happens. Yep, you can't control how they're going to respond to you. And so in some ways, you can't let their response kind of influence your values and what you find is important. You have to kind of just kind of keep that steadiness that the Buddha talked to originally with the fear and the terror. You have to keep that steadiness with what you're doing. Just stay on your path and keep doing it. And you need to exemplify and say out loud what your values are. I remember I learned this lesson really well because I think it's a bit like when someone says, have you stopped beating your wife yet? Yeah? And there's really no reply to it? Yeah? Because you can't deny it, you kind of can't say, I've never been able to figure this out completely, but you can't say, oh no, I don't beat her anymore, because then they kind of saying you did beat her before. But I remember once I was having difficulties with someone, and I found myself always getting into these tangles with this person in terms of language. You know, he would say, oh, you're trying to do this or you're trying to do that. And I would say, no, I'm not trying to do that. You know, I'd defend it, and I'd sort of like enter into the terms of his criticism. And what I found is that whenever I did that, I was just doomed. He was a lawyer. And he was very good. And it was like me denying that I'm doing it somehow just gave him more fuel for wanting to jump in on it and kind of prove me wrong and pull my words apart. And I can remember I really sussed it out, I thought, when I just started saying stuff instead of kind of denying it, saying things instead like, well, that would be really terrible if I did that, wouldn't it? Yeah? I would really not want to do that. You know, I would feel like I've let myself down if I treated you that way. Yeah? If that was my motivation, I'd, you know, and it was just like, in a way, kind of taking his argument on its own terms, but then saying, yeah, that is serious. And because it's serious, you know, in a way, I didn't even have to say that I wouldn't do it. I just said, yeah, I value that too. I wouldn't want to do that. And it just all dispelled it. It was really amazing. It was really amazing. And I think that's what this example from the Buddha's life is kind of talking towards. So another story from the Buddha's life, and this is the one that Sujiva talked about at another occasion, which is Ajatasattu. So with Ajatasattu, he basically was an Indian prince who killed his dad to take over the throne. So he killed his dad and took over. And so he was kind of plagued with fear, you could say. Yeah. But at one point, he's trying to find some peace, and he ends up going into the forest and visiting the Buddha. And as he's entering the forest, he's being led here by an advisor. And of course, he killed his dad off, so you know he's probably thinking, well, you know, who's around the corner for me? You know, where are the daggers that are going to go into my side? And he's just being led deeper into the forest, and it's perfectly still and quiet. But he's being told that there are hundreds of monks out here meditating. So since there's hundreds of monks, why can't he hear them? You know, because if there were hundreds of people living in the forest, he'd hear them. So, but he doesn't. So he's actually getting quite fearful, yeah? But he does continue. And in the end, he comes to where the Buddha is, and the Buddha's sitting. And they have some talks, and he asks the Buddha some questions. And one of the questions he asks, or the main question he asks, is what are the virtues of the contemplative life? So I think this is interesting because Ajatasattu is someone who was willing to murder his father for material wealth, for power, and for status. And in a way, that's like kind of one of the most extreme forms of murder, to murder someone who raised you. But when the Buddha kind of talks about this, the first thing he says is that one of the virtues of living the contemplative life is that currently, if you were a slave, and he's the king. You know, the slave actually has none of the things that the king has. Yeah, a slave lives a very impoverished life in comparison to what Ajatasattu's riches were. But if that slave were to pursue a spiritual life, to pursue a life of greater, you know, pursuing spiritual values, greater nobility, well then, if he were to kind of pursue that and the king were to meet him, how would the king greet him? And Ajatasattu says, well, if I were to meet someone who was a spiritual practitioner, I'd meet them with reverence, and I'd make them offerings. You know, I'd give them food, I'd give them clothing and stuff. So, and then he goes on, he says, well, if someone's a farmer and someone's working for you, once again, relative to you, they're quite impoverished. But if they were to kind of take on this spiritual life, you know, how would you respond to them? You know? And Ajatasattu again says, well, if they, you know, no matter if they were a farmer in the past, if they started practicing a spiritual life, once again, I would give them, you know, kind of alms and clothing and stuff like that, support them. So the Buddha makes the point that you know, whereas when you're pursuing status and wealth and stuff, there is a hierarchy. You know, there's people that have those things, and there's people that don't have them. There's people that have power, and there's people that don't have power. There's people who have status, and people that don't have status. But when you start to step over into the spiritual life, all of that gets kind of equated. It just becomes a bit more kind of leveled out. And in fact, people with wealth and status and power do respect those qualities. Yep. So that's what the Buddha's saying. And the reason I grabbed this one to kind of present tonight was that I kind of felt like I think when you're talking about ill will and hatred and kind of aversion and compassion, it's kind of obvious. But I think when it comes to turning away from worldly success, it's not so obvious. Yeah? And it's interesting because this is not turning away, but you do turn away from some things, don't you, in order to not turn away from others. And the not turning away in this sense is the not turning away from what's truly meaningful in life. Yeah, not turning away from that. And I think that when you pursue what's truly meaningful in life, I think that on those terms, we're all equal. Yep. So in this room tonight, there's a lot of people from very, very different backgrounds, very, very different economic, kind of socio-demographic kind of places in the world, different ages and everything. But as kind of people who are interested in the Dharma life, we are all the same. And hopefully we feel that. Yep. And I think that is a really beautiful quality. I think I think it's only found in a spiritual community. I think that only in a spiritual community can you leave behind kind of your history and all those kind of trappings that normally define us, and you're just met as a human being. You're just met as someone with the potential for awakening that is trying to move on that path. And that's the basis on which we meet one another. Yep. And I think not turning away from that is beautiful. Yep, I think it's really beautiful to be able to relate to people on that level. I think it's just really amazing. And I think everybody responds to it. So the last story that I'm going to share with you is one that many of you will probably already know about, because it's very popular, but I don't think we've talked about it in a while here on these nights. But it's Kisago to me and the mustard seed. Yes, yes. So the story of Kisago to me and the mustard seed is that Kisago to me is a lower class Indian woman, and she's basically she's without position, but a man who is of a higher position falls in love with her and marries her. And I think she's basically kind of really destitute. That's the feeling you get of a woman that really has almost nothing going for her. It's not working, and except for the love of her husband. And out of that love, They get married, and she has a baby, and that baby's a boy. And she takes a lot of pride in this baby boy. But unluckily, or unhappily, or tragically, her husband gets sick and dies, and then her baby gets sick and dies. And she can't really accept this. So this baby and this falling apart of her world is so great that she's insisting that her baby's just sick. The baby's not dead, it's just sick. And she's going around to people saying, I need someone to cure my baby because my baby's sick. And people are looking at her, realizing the baby's dead, but, you know, and they even try to tell her that. She's like, no, you don't understand, you can't help me, I'll move on. In the end, someone does say, well, maybe you could go talk to the Buddha. Maybe the Buddha will be able to help you. So she goes and talks to the Buddha. And the Buddha, you know, as she comes up to the Buddha, everybody's looking at her thinking she's got a dead baby kind of on her side that she's holding. It's like, what's he going to do? What's he going to do with this woman? And they don't know what's going to happen. But the Buddha says to her, yeah, I can cure your baby. I think he probably said something like, I can cure the situation. I can help you. Thank you. Yep. But in order to help you, what I need you to do is I need you to find me a mustard seed, to bring me a mustard seed. And she's like, yeah, no trouble. Mustard seeds are very common. It's a bit like, you know, getting salt in a house today. So, and he goes, well, wait, but the mustard seed has to come from a home which has never lost anybody, where no one's died before. She's like, oh, okay. Well, that might be a bit harder, but there's a lot of mustard seed out there. I'm sure I can find some. So she goes searching for mustard seed, and she knocks on door after door after door after door. And of course, you know the response she gets. It's one of, yes, I can help you. I have mustard seed. Is there anybody that's died here? And the immediate response is, don't remind me. You know, actually, I lost my husband 5 years ago. Or I lost my son. Or I lost my mother. You know, and she just got story after story after story of families that had lost people they loved. People who died. And in the end, she puts the baby down. She buries the baby and goes back to the Buddha. I don't know what she says. Something like she goes back to the Buddha, and the Buddha says, "Well, how did you go?" And she says, "The mustard seed's done its work." You know, it's like I get it. And then she actually became a follower of the Buddha. But I thought this was another aspect of not turning away, in the sense that, you know, the Buddha kind of encouraged her to go into the situation and to explore the situation for herself. Because I think when we don't turn away from difficult situations, the insights we can get from them are very, very, they can be very embodied, because the situations are very real, because they involve us. So we're in them. So if we can go into difficult situations, you know, informed by, you know, the Dharma, supported by the practices that we do, supported by the Sangha, then we have the chance to make some real breakthroughs. So, yeah, I think the story of Kisagotomi is one of those stories of not turning away also. And in the end, she sees through her delusions. So in conclusion, I think the response of fear and terror with courage and perseverance, and the response to suffering and neglect with action, compassion, and confession, and a response to abuse and ill will with commitment and exemplification, and a response to pleasure and sensual cravings with a going forth, a letting go, and a contentment, and responding to delusion with embodied reflection and insight in the nature of reality are sort of the different lessons from these stories. So the practice of not turning away is the practice of not accepting a situation on its own literal, seemingly obvious terms. You know, in a way what we do is we reframe it how we'd normally see it. We've reframed it. And what we're doing is we're responding with a creative mind rather than the reactive mind, if you know that framework. We're not allowing the eight worldly winds to determine our direction, and we're instead practicing and responding with the Dharma. And we're reflecting on situations in alignment with the Dharma in order to see through them. So that's all I have to say tonight on the practice of not turning away. But I was thinking that, you know, we could do questions, but also I was thinking that there are probably other, you know, there are probably other kind of perspectives on this too that people have, or kind of situations where they haven't turned away and they've managed to break through to something. And so if anybody wants to share some of those or share some of their experiences stuff, that'd be great. So, but that's me.